Wait, can I ask you a question really quick? Did you see the Manosphere thing with Louis Theroux, the new one?
I did, yeah.
Yeah, what did you think about it?
Let's put this behind the paywall because it's a little bit too in the weeds for, most people. But I am kind of curious to discuss it. And I talked about it with some of the podcasters who have been broadly lumped into that sphere, I think incorrectly, like just podcasts that guys like, more or less, not like political stuff. I thought that Louis' targets were fair. I think that pretty much everyone in the show is a bad actor. Myron Gaines, I think, is the guy. Like, these people are, they fucking suck. I have, like, no sympathy for whatever. When it comes to the, like, Rogans and the Lex Friedmans and those types that have been kind of, like, put into Manosphere content, I think that's incorrect. I think that is more so in the, like, Zinternet analysis of Max Reed. Because it's just popular with, like, normal people.
Right.
And they have majority male audiences, but they're not, they are qualitatively very different from like the Andrew Tates of the world. And I think that mainstream media, legacy journalists basically see these organizations or podcasts as their competition. And so they attempt to smear mainstream stuff with the most fringe radical elements and say, oh, look, there's a pipeline. There's a pipeline between these two things. It's like, yeah, the audience is like 100 million people. Of course, small fraction of them are also going to be interested in this other thing that's really bad. But it's a terrible posture to take to say, like, these very popular podcasts are, they're all bad. There's, the whole audience, like, must be written off. They're in that fascist percentage of society. So I thought that Louis, I don't know him. I haven't talked with him about the documentary. But I thought, you know, I went into it being like, this is going to be rough. And I thought, he's actually taking very fair shots. I had basically no complaints with it. Did you have... What was your interpretation of
that? My biggest complaint is not digging into why all of them are anti-Semitic and why they constantly construct the paradigm of Jews are doing this, and to just paper over that and be like, this is just the kooky, like internet stuff where they're all anti-Semites they're all like misogynists. And it's like, well, hold on. Like, because I have, you know, I think doing a disservice to really deconstructing these belief systems and understanding why they are attractive. Because it makes it seem like there's a hidden truth.
Yeah. Do you believe, though, that like Sneeko, for example, does he have any core belief in anything? Or is he just, whatever gets the most clicks, that's my belief system today?
I think he believes what he says. I think a lot of these people do. It's really hard to really prove that someone is like a sheer grifter for the sake of like literally just pivoting their positions to get clicks. I think all of these people are very hardcore believers.
Well, that one guy, the fitness guy in Spain, like he was clearly like, I hate OnlyFans, I hate porn, but I'll promote these people. Like that was very cut and dry. But then for the Sneekos, it's like, he's getting a lot of clicks, but then he also brought on, friend of the show, Alexander Dugan and Professor Jang. And so he is kind of building a platform
for
a far-right philosophical worldview.
Yeah, it's fascinating, right?
Yeah, we can't just say it's like, oh, he's memeing.
No. And that's why I think it's dangerous to not explore what that quote-unquote worldview is that he's trying to dissect, which is absolutely cartoonish. But it is rooted in something that people are outraged about, which is this horrific genocide that we're all watching that the media is lying about. So again, when you go back to why did Trump win? We know innately that we are lied to, that we're being gaslit. We have a deep distrust in institutional legacy media that lied to us about 9/11, the Iraq War, all of these things. So that's where Bannon and Trump really siphoned all that energy into like fake news and calling these things for what they are. But then again, folding everyone into these right-wing periphery and the right-wing figures in media. Yeah, yeah. But that's where I think Louis Theroux really lost the plot, is like, we're not digging into why these things flourish, why they're generated in the first place, when you just completely ignore the fact that the media is lying about Israel and not digging into why that happens, because it's maintaining this power structure where Israel's an appendage of the U.S., right? Yeah, and it's all activated in the same way. That's really problematic. And it continues to make people think that there's a secret forbidden knowledge that they're being tuned into. And that's why they...
So in this idea of like pre-selecting media, this is 1,000% going behind the paywall. If Louis Theroux held the political analysis that what is required to prevent anti-establishment sentiment flowing into right-wing populism, that the kind of missing necessary ingredient is a rigorously disciplined Leninist vanguard. You'd probably not be allowed on the BBC. So there may be, he's kind of given those permissions to touch these topics because he might not take the political analysis as far as you or I might.
Yeah.
Does that sound
I think it's fair, but it also folds people back into these modes of thought that ultimately does a disservice and continues to silo these people off and make it more attractive. Mm-hmm. That's what I was worried about. If I were someone who was, you know, like you talk about like the undecided voters, that's fucking crazy to me whenever like an election comes up and it's like the day before the election, people are like, ah, I don't know, like I haven't decided yet. And it's like, what the
coin.
Fuck? Like, like who are these people?
I like them both. I just like them both so much.
They both speak to me. Who would I have a beer with? But the sneak, like I was watching the Louis Theroux thing and I just thought like, I don't know if I would be convinced that of this. If I were just like a young guy watching this, I don't, I just don't know. And that's what worries me. There wasn't enough explained about, and you're right, obviously he's not going to go into media literacy and how you can like holistically understand why the media acts in a certain way. But when we don't do those things, and again, all of these people, there is a current that goes through all of them, anti-Semitism and misogyny. It's we're not really unpacking why.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is maybe too far of a rabbit hole to chase, but the Dugin position, as fucking wacky and cobbled together as that shit is, but anti-liberalism being pre-modernism, anti-modernism, and post-modernism all combined kind of gives you this like zigzag. You can throw in anything that you want. And Sneeko, clearly some of these content creators really embody that like trifecta of anti-liberal politics.
It makes me uncomfortable because I was the victim of deplatforming 10 years ago. My show Breaking the Set on Russia Today was memory hold once RT got banned in the States and
2012 to 15.
2012 to 15, 600 episodes deleted. And kind of like a modern equivalent to book burning. So it was really crazy to see, you know, my own work get lumped into this notion that it was trying to protect us.
Yeah.
Right. And I find that really infantilizing. Like, as someone who's really critical of US foreign policy and who talks about these issues a lot, I find it imperative that we hear what Putin is saying, what Assad is saying, what Xi Jinping is saying.
I agree.
I had never seen an interview with them like that. Mm-hmm. And then they just ban all media from us. We can't even hear from these world leaders that are deemed enemies. So that's really cartoonish and absurd and infantilizing. And I think it goes back to Hillary Clinton basket of deplorables thing. You're making these viewpoints unsavory and somehow forbidden and more attractive to people who already have deep distrust in these institutions.
Now they're punk rock. Yeah.
And now Christianity is the new punk rock.
No, I'm steeply on the rise for young men, actually. I just saw some stats the other day. So let's explore this for a little bit here.
Conservatism is the new counterculture. I find that so fascinating because it's really not. This is the weird idea with this, the Bannon and Trump and MAGA thing to position liberal hegemony, right? Because queer people are like in positions of power, they think that liberalism is like the doctrine and mantra of the way that we garner society. And it's just really bizarre because it's just so obviously conservative. That's every institution is run by conservatives. It's all conservative thought. It's just that we see gay people like in entertainment, and it's just bizarre. That's why there's so much attention on college campuses, because it's like the last bastion of like even discussing these things. So this weird false notion of liberal hegemony, and this is perpetrated by people like Glenn Greenwald, that liberal media controls everything, when really, this is a myth. This is a myth. Conservatives control the media spectrum. And even like the most popular podcasters, the most popular, all these people online, even in our field, are still conservatives. The most popular radio people, I mean, all of AM radio, all of TV, it's like, it's just really fascinating how little perspectives are outside of the confines of conservative thought.
Okay, let's explore this a little bit.
Okay.
So I agree. Alt media, 90% conservative. Media Matters study, I've referenced this like a dozen episodes now. 90% conservative on alt media. However, in legacy media, affiliation with the Democratic Party, I'm going to forget the exact statistics from a few years ago, but notable newsrooms, you have something like a similar 90% affiliation with the Democratic Party versus Republicans. So in one sense, alt media...
When you say legacy media, what are you talking about?
Places like cable news or newspapers or things that did not start as a digital first YouTube channel, for example. This would be New York Times, Washington Post, things where there is an editor between the journalist and what this paper puts out, where the alt media landscape is primarily individual driven, that is, you know, more editorial, no gatekeeper kind of thing. There are blurry distinctions now with like the Daily Wire, for example, but we can draw, I think, a very rough distinction between MSNBC and like individual conservative commentator who does a live stream without naming any particular names. In those newsrooms, it is overwhelmingly aligned with the Democratic Party. And so I'm just going to try and run through all of these incredibly uncomfortable topics here, but I think we need to take the college campus thing seriously, because the cost of higher education has become astronomical, unprecedentedly astronomical. And so you're dealing with an increasingly uneven society where you have these very economically privileged elites who are given an ideological worldview about what topics matter and are most politically urgent. And those topics don't have to deal with class because these kids are fucking rich. And then the problem is you drop it into Section 230 social media, where everything we hear is about trans kids, everything we hear is about queer kids, none of it is about class. And of course, what is going to happen to audiences is they're going to think that the right-wing populists are the opposition. Like, these are profoundly uncomfortable topics, but if you line all of those things up, that's how you get today's media ecosystem.
No, I totally agree.
And so the task for us is to, like, how can we disentangle these issues about, like, you know, the liberty that you have for your individual identity and civil rights and so on, if they have for now, like 10, 15 years, become so inextricably entangled that most of the Democratic population, like most voting people in America, see these issues and they think that this signals to them the Democrats are not serious about the economy. And that's why the working class votes for Trump. And basically our inability to, you know, do a little bit of self-criticism about this stuff. Like, we don't need to carry water for the Sarah Lawrence college kids. Mm-hmm. You know, they're paying $65,000 a semester. Like, this is not a representative of the workers' movement. This is not a representative of the left. And I think so, yeah, it sounds a little bit silly, but the college campus politics, if you told that to TPUSA, for example, like, that's where they recruit. That's where they get all of these young right-wing people who are now this, like, kind of nationalist, emergent youth conservative wing within their institutions. And you get the White House posting, like, shit that was, like, Hyperborea memes from, like, five years ago. It has been pretty powerful in terms of intellectual production. So, after that whole kind of mess of I am now canceled a dozen ways over, what do you want to do about campus politics? How do you feel about the divisions between alt and legacy media?
I mean, I totally think you're right. I think this is why we're in the situation that we're in, because legacy media has failed and they represent, which is supposed to be the opposition to this conservative mode of thought that's been dominant strain forever. And so when you had these openings of liberal, like, modes of thought about individual liberty and free speech and... No, I mean, not even that. I mean, individual rights and representation, let's say. So when you saw queer people and marginalized people historically of other races and things like that elevated to representation, it was really great, right? But unfortunately, because of capital accumulation, because of not real representation and changing society, it was just a hollowed out tokenizing thing that was just co-opting people's real struggles. And so of course it's going to have a backlash. Of course people are going to become reactionaries seeing what the Democratic Party has done. I think this is the biggest problem right now with the Democratic Party, is they represent nothing except capital accumulation with the veneer of, you know, representation and identity politics. And it's so hollowed out and it's so hypocritical. In the wake of the Gaza genocide, we know through the post-mortem that that was the death knell for Kamala. Yeah. But they're never going to rectify it. They're never going to look in the mirror and say, we need to change. Because it's all about self-preservation. It's about maintaining that corporate shell of themselves. That's who they are. So I blame this husk for the fissure in society, the huge moving over and siphoning over into right-wing politics, into that sphere, because of the hypocrisy, the sheer hypocrisy of it all. It makes people feel like they are not trustworthy, they don't represent anything real, and they want something to blame for the problems of their lives. And so, of course, they're going to punch down. It's easier to blame trans people or immigrants than it is to blame the billionaires. And then you feel like you need to have power and agency to do something about it, to reorient yourself and reorganize or somehow become part of a collective to point to who's actually perpetrating these problems. So, of course, it's easier. But I ultimately, it is the fault of this liberal narrative and liberal establishment to never give us a holistic understanding of why things are the way they are. There's this collective memory loss. There's this imperialist fervor that now you can actually, for the longest time, the right wing had a coup that they were the actual anti-war party. How is that a thing?
That's crazy,
How
bro.
Is that a thing? Yeah, and then when you come on the heels of this crackdown on like free speech and you're like, well, you guys used to be the party of like free speech and anti-war, and now we are. It's like, why did they give that? Why did they even give an iota, a modicum of rhetoric to be seized by the right wing? And that was a huge mistake. But it's because they don't believe in anything real. They didn't believe in the principles of actual liberal democracy. If they did, they would have fought for those values. And they didn't. They let the right wing take them.
A little bit in the weeds, but on the topic of the war in Gaza, Crystal Ball, I think, said this to us, and it stuck with me for the past few months. But she was saying that, you know, it's not that every American is making their decisions at the ballot box about what the U.S. is doing overseas. There's a portion that is. We can debate, you know, how large that demographic is. But she was also saying that there's kind of a knock-on effect of counter-signaling Israel just implies so many other anti-establishment positions that you tend to assume that someone is like for healthcare, for like all of these other issues. Do you feel a similar way that like there's a dozen issues kind of bundled in together on this one topic right now, which has made it so kind of politically potent?
Yeah, I mean, I think Gaza changed the world for so many reasons, primarily really exploded the falsehoods perpetuated by legacy media, alternative viewpoint of Palestinians being able to dictate to us what their reality was. So it totally deconstructs that lockdown narrative that's been forced down our throats for so long, not just about Israel.
But Israel
was kind of the guiding light for the nature of U.S. foreign policy, right? So all of this has been exposed. And during the Iraq War, the messaging about Palestine was considered too controversial during anti-war organizing. Even during Occupy Wall Street, I remember being in Frank Ogawa Plaza in Oakland, and Obama's headquarters were like right down the street. And people were like, no, like Obama's different. This is about Wall Street, even though his cabinet was entirely constructed of Wall Street figures. Now with Gaza, it does seem like there is this understanding of how Gaza is the connective tissue, how Gaza is intrinsically connected to our liberation, our collective liberation, how everything is tied together. It's not just some far off place that has nothing to do with us. People really understand how their poverty is directly tied to us bombing kids in Gaza. And I've never seen that with Americans having that understanding before. So there is something different about this moment and the exposure that Gaza's brought that has synthesized things in a way for people to really bring it home and to expose just the failure of all these institutions that were supposed to protect people that were supposed to prevent this atrocity from happening again in the world. So there's several things happening at once that provides a really interesting moment that I think is very novel.
Yeah.
That's ours for the taking, frankly.
You know, I'm glad we're hitting every extremely uncomfortable topic today. It's been exciting and interesting talking to you. I think it may be even larger in that, like, the story of the latter half of the 20th century post-World War II, like, the legitimacy, seemingly, of, like, the liberal world order hinged on, you know, the extraordinary atrocities of World War II, and specifically the Holocaust. And so now to see a supposedly liberal state conduct a similar type of cruelty that every international, not every, but the overwhelming majority of international institutions have described as genocide, is just having the effect of invalidating the belief system that most privileged Americans post 1989, for example, have, like, certainly held very strongly. And it has caused us, just as you said, like, incredible, incredible reckoning. On the topic of national embarrassment, the opening scene of the film, you talk to a man. What is his professional background? Where is he now?
Levon. I lost touch with Levon. Levon is a homeless man living in Brentwood, California, one of the wealthier areas of LA, but it was because the Veterans Hospital was there, and there was a camp out in front of the VA hospital called Veterans Row. And this is so people could go to the VA and get prescriptions and whatnot and just have their home base right out front. It's a very dystopian landscape, because how is that possible that you have a homeless encampment of veterans outside of a VA hospital?
Right.
And I was speaking to this man, and I could not believe my ears when he told me that he was actually in an Army recruiting commercial.
Yeah.
And
I remember
he reenacted
that commercial.
It. I remember
from
that
when
commercial
I was younger.
Too.
Yeah.
I remember that commercial. And he reenacted the commercial. And when we found the commercial, it was just it was just absolutely horrifying to see it and to just to think this is a perfect example of someone who quite literally, like, used specifically for propaganda purposes. His life destroyed in Iraq. And then he's left to die on the streets of LA. He can't even use his hands. You know, he has no feeling in his hands because of the hydraulic fluid that basically just has destroyed the nerve endings of his fingers. And he's sitting there playing the piano. And then we went there that day because we knew that the camp was going to be destroyed. And it just comes full circle. It's like Levon, to me, represents everything. It's what Thomas Young, that paralyzed veteran who died a couple years ago, who was paralyzed in the Iraq War, and he wrote a letter to Dick Cheney just saying, "We are the human detritus. This is what you have done to us. We are the sacrificial lambs." And that's what Levon is. He represents the human detritus of this system. The people who are used for propaganda purposes, the people who are used, chewed up and spit out in the streets. This is the real representation of America, and he represents everything. I mean, the destruction of his tent, of his piano, that's the destruction of everything that's sacred in this beautiful earth. Everything that these maniacs are robbing from us, everything that they're killing and destroying, that's Levon, that's his tent, that's everything. So at first I didn't even want we didn't know if we should put the scene in the movie because it wasn't explicitly about environmental pollution, but then it just became so glaringly obvious that his story represents all of us and everything. And it's the connective tissue with Gaza, with, I don't know, just everything that's going on in the world.
It also reaches across to many different audiences that would be sympathetic to this. You described your politics before as anti-imperialist, and there's a lot of people who maybe don't agree on the nitty-gritty of left-wing theory or whatever. They can just be libertarian or who knows what. But many people will be sympathetic to that type of story. What strain of anti-imperialist politics do you come from? Like, what is your, 'cause these things are such dire emergencies. Like, what is step one for how to adjust this kind of, ongoing crisis?
I mean, as someone who was hoodwinked by capitalism, most of my young life. I mean, even critiquing capitalism didn't even become something that was acceptable until essentially Occupy Wall Street for me. And so I was a dyed in the wool, like I not only capitalist, but I just thought I'm not that. And so I'm not a socialist. Yeah. I'm not a communist. I must be an anarchist, right? I hate the government. I hate war. I hate what these people are doing. And so I must be an anarchist. And so I was like the third way, which I didn't really understand how to describe myself. And then over time, of course, you do a lot of reading and get rooted in theory. And I understood that actually capitalism was the driving force of the machinery of imperialism. Mm-hmm. I think that when you get to a state of this, especially this monopoly capitalism, where you have, it necessitates constant inequality, constant expansion on a finite planet, it inevitably is going to lead to war. And so this is the stage that we're in now. And so I'm an anti-imperialist, it's rooted in my anti-capitalist beliefs. And so when I do talk to libertarians about this, it kind of always goes back to their belief that we're not in a true capitalist model, that this isn't true capitalism.
It's crony
capitalism.
This is
like social, crony capitalism. Yeah, yeah. Like somehow it's like socialism for the ruling class when it's just bizarre. And it's also kind of goes back to like the bad apples at the top. And for me, the system rewards the worst characteristics of humanity. Mm-hmm. That's why Donald Trump is the perfect representation of capitalism.
Well, there's something underneath this that I'm curious to get to, and we'll just explore this. I don't have this figured out, but monopoly capitalism, there's kind of two forking interpretations that one might take here, which is that we need to do trust busting and break up these big companies, like turn Amazon, Twitch, Whole Foods back into separate companies, but also just break up any kind of logistical monopoly that is larger than the size of the United States. The other interpretation of that is, well, monopoly capitalism is like one way to describe it, but if we were to do like IBM and purchase a large portion of the shares by which we could have then like the state essentially would have democratic input about what the company chooses to pursue, how they conduct themselves. You then have kind of a weird balance because you are allowing the deep state to own it and be hopeful that it's accountable to the democratic will.
Yeah,
right. But which of those kind of forking interpretations appeals to you to, you know, say soft nationalize some of these companies or to do the trust busting?
Yeah, I think it depends on the companies. I mean, it's hard to say. I mean, definitely like things in the public interest, like internet, you know, telecommunications, things like that, all should be completely nationalized. AI.
Natural monopolies, yes. So to speak. Yeah.
Yes, I 100% agree with that. But yeah, I think incrementally now, like the very least that can happen is breaking up the ability to merger everything and consult. I mean, it's like, what is the difference between what Paramount just did and like the critique on what China does? I mean, it's just so weird. It's like we allow these things under capitalism and to become just like one body without any sort of democratic governance.
Yeah.
You know, even in like Gulf monarchies, it's like people have UBI and healthcare. It's like to stave off the kind of frog in boiling water, you know, that's happening, this pressure cooker. Here, it's what do they expect is going to happen? I mean,
you would think that the state would be ashamed to have homeless veterans out in front of the VA.
Right.
And they don't even like try to hide it or like put them somewhere else out of sight.
Yeah.
It's just openly dysfunctional.
Right.
Like, why don't we have some kind of fucking like Gulf UBI, for example, right?
It is so weird. It's like you think that just to stave off the inevitability of the pitchforks, right?
Yeah.
Sam Altman doesn't want a Molotov cocktail being thrown at his house in San Francisco. Like, you want to give the peon something.
Right.
Like, other than just brain rot.
Yeah,
I mean, is that enough, I guess?
Right.
Is that enough just to be brain rotted and to be distracted into oblivion that we don't need actually anything tangible?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. This is a question that is, you know, very, very broad reaching, but I'm trying to ask people on the podcast going forward, like, we've done a lot of kind of autopsy on the last few years. Like, what could have happened to prevent us from getting here, right? Like, your kind of worst imaginings in, like, 2015, 16, like, we are now exceeding those things. Mm-hmm. Like, it's getting pretty fucking bad pretty rapidly. What are the, like, key points at which we could have turned off and had some different type of outcome?
I mean, the easiest thing to say is letting Bernie win. No, I mean,
that
look.
Sure.
Yeah. But then again, it's the sheepdogging. I'm almost happy that it was all exposed.
Mm-hmm.
Because I've always been really disillusioned with politics ever since I was of voting age, after I did the swing state trip for Kerry.
Mm-hmm.
Jesus Christ, God help me. but after that, I was like, oh, Republicans are evil incarnate. And then I was just like, wait, no, it's not the Republicans. It's Nancy Pelosi not holding war criminals to account. Why is impeachment off the table for Bush? And then I was like, why mm-hmm. is the media mm-hmm. covering for these people?
Mm-hmm.
So then over time, you're like, it's the entirety of the system. I think holding Iraq war criminals to account, I think actual accountability, not letting this level of impunity reign mm-hmm. supreme, would have prevented Gaza from happening, would have mm-hmm. prevented this kind of system that we're witnessing today,
you
which
mean
is
by
the
setting
law
an international
of the,
precedent?
Yes,
okay.
It is. It does feel like the law of the jungle. I mean, we're in a new stage that's quite horrifying because you have this technological overlap where we can watch and witness everything horrible happening, yet there's no the pretense of any sort of semblance of human rights and democracy is completely collapsed. These international bodies that were created to try to have some sort of egalitarian nature of the rule of law have completely collapsed. They're always just, they've been exposed as faces of U.S. power, right?
Mm-hmm,
as fronts for U.S. power. So there's something really devastating about the moment that we're in. Francesca Albanese says it's we're teetering on the edge of hope and the abyss.
Hmm.
And I think that what we do now to reshape the way that the world is formed, I mean, it's not the law isn't the problem, it's the application of the law, right?
That's the thing, is that the law exists, international
right.
law we're talking about here, but
right.
like, what are the institutions or courts that have any kind of lever of power right now? Because it kind of seems like words written on paper rather than anything meaningfully enforceable.
Yeah. I mean, I'm a poli-sci major and my entire belief system of checks and balances is now I just realize it's just decorum and respectability politics.
Right.
If you don't care about the legislative branch, you don't need to do anything.
Yeah.
Just paperwork that piles up at your doorstep.
This is... I mean, it sounds like kind of a simple question, but these are actually like kind of deep rabbit holes for the left.
Yeah.
Because if you were, say, for example, not a Western Marxist,
mm-hmm.
those questions can be resolved by, say, a Maoist third worldist
mm-hmm.
view or approach where the state is the military, is backed up by might, is backed up by force, and there is no contradiction there. But if you're trying to have a democratic approach and do deliberation and all of these kind of progressive values, like, we are just seemingly completely toothless right now, and we have to really meaningfully rethink these things.
I don't even know
where to start with it, because we are just, there's an open genocide that's happening, and there is no lever of power by which to push back or stop it from happening, seeming. So the temptation is like, well, yeah, we should be like a Leninist vanguard,
mm-hmm.
and we should take over the state, and we should be the military. And that opens up entirely different avenues for democratic organization and so on.
Yeah. I mean, that's the whole guiding principle of why neoliberalism has become or was so successful and sanctified, is because it had this notion of like liberal democracy on top of capital accumulation at all costs.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so that seemed to be contrary to like what, you know, socialism and stuff, which is really unfortunate.
But it gave you a little internationalism as a treat.
As a treat.
Right? You kind of got that through globalization.
Yes.
Even though it wasn't like the good kind,
right.
but it was there in some way.
Yeah. And I think looking at the world today, and you look at DPRK and Cuba, and it's hard to even envision what these countries would be like without living under the boot of the threats of subversion and interference from the U.S. And so it's hard to even say that is a necessary component of that political system.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think it's a reaction and a response, just like we're saying they should have got nukes.
Right.
That's the way the world works today. It's like you can't even imagine what the world would be like if it wasn't for the U.S. enforcing its will.
Mm-hmm.
But I think components of course, I think democratic values are can be shared with socialist ideals. And I think we need to continue to fight for that.
For example, like we were talking before about what percentage of society is fascist. Like what percentage of North Koreans actually believe the rhetoric of Juche, for example, right? Like there's an underlying question here of like how ideologically and philosophically moldable are people? And this this strikes me as like one of the examples because there's like a, you know, 100% consensus on everything that comes out of that government.
Yeah.
How many people actually believe it?
It's a really, really good question. I've been thinking about this a lot in the wake of the Gaza genocide, not only shattering my beliefs on the notion that everyone's reachable if they just knew.
Mm-hmm.
If you just knew how horrible things were, then you would care and you would act upon that information. Now I don't believe that.
You can raise all the awareness in the world and you still can't reach them.
You still can't reach them, but there is a contingent of society that actually revels in the suffering. And I don't know if people are born sociopathic or without empathy, or if they're just beaten down or broken by the system that commodifies everything, that demonizes people, that kind of, you know, indoctrinates us into this subjugation and dehumanization of the other. I don't know what, why that is the way it is, but it exists.
Yeah.
There is a very strong contingent that likes this.
And it existed that I've had before capitalism, too.
Of course.
Like, there were public executions under feudalism. And like, this is a human characteristic.
This is a human characteristic. And you can
degree.
Honestly look at, you know, I always thought this, too. Like, you can look at movies like Saw. There's this notion that we've made into a fantasy, but that still exists, where humans want to see the gore and the carnage and people killed and murdered and
we haven't
limitless.
Published this yet, but we just did a whole episode about the Saw movies actually precisely on this.
So bizarre.
I didn't tell you about that, so it's
but
just
it's
funny
like,
that
but it's like the Roman Coliseum. It's like it's still the same thing, except we can put it into entertainment and have it behind where it's now constructed for us instead of like reality. But that's what's so disturbing to me is I don't know. Look, I think, and I've heard these mathematical breakdowns and I can't really like cite them statistically, but I know it doesn't, history happens quickly and it doesn't take much of the population to get that wave going. Whether it's 5%, 10%, it's like, I think the vast majority of people are waiting for that to be activated and then they'll join the herd. But I think there is a strong component of people who cannot be changed and who are not reachable. And that's beyond the out and out fascists. I think that there's, and I think by and large, there's a trauma response going on.
Okay.
There's a huge amount of people who have reverted into conspiratorial frameworks and cult-like thinking because it's easier.
Yes.
It's easier than to deal with what's right in front of your face. See what you see. Don't be duped.
Right.
But it's too hard to acknowledge how difficult it is. 20 years ago, people were talking much more honestly about climate change, actually, than they are now.
Yeah.
Now it's DEI firefighters. Now it's you know, space beams from... You know, I don't know what it is, but
I'm
it seems like
say
we're
kind of
so
space laser
we are not rooted in a consensus reality anymore.
I'll tell you if the cameras are not rolling. This I was like, that's really funny, but like
what?
That'll send us to prison. So there's a comedian. There's a comedian. I'll deny knowing this person. I've never heard of them before. This was a character in Minecraft. He said, "I used to feel bad about the environment. And then I realized that even if I bike to work every day for the rest of my life, it would save less fuel than the test flight for one fighter jet. So I've decided I'm going to consume as much as I want and then make up for it with one devastating act of eco-terrorism on my way out." Don't put that in the episode.
But you're quoting someone.
Yeah, in Minecraft. I don't know where the camera is. In Minecraft. On my way out of Minecraft.